Well, we're going to pick up again in our study in Genesis. We are still in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, and the reason for that is because we are taking an in-depth look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. We really want to grasp this passage. Well, the idea so far in Genesis chapter 1, there is going to be quite a bit of review here, but please don't tune me out because I am going to be adding a few things in that we haven't touched on before in the review. But anyway, what's happening here in Genesis chapter 1 is essentially this. God is creating a cosmos, and He is creating the cosmos as this temple in which His glory will dwell. And in this temple, He has placed His image bearers. He has placed man and woman, male and female, Adam and Eve, and their progeny after them to fill this temple and to be as priests before God in this temple. And so the question that we have then is, well, what does it really mean then to be made in the image of God? How does that play into this whole image and idea that's been presented before us? And as I've mentioned before, essentially the idea of being made in the image of God is this idea. It's that we've been made for His glory and we've been made for His glory. That's the best way we can put it. The way that the Catechism puts it is that we have this end, we have this purpose, we have this goal as human beings to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And we see that in the way the verse is written. We've been made in the image of God. That is, we were made to be that which magnifies His glory. We are the image of all of the glory of God's attributes. We're made in His image, but we're also made after His likeness, which is to say that we were made to be like God. We were made, therefore, to relate to God, to find our joy and our happiness and our satisfaction in God. Right? Those are the ideas of being made in the image of God. It's really talking or speaking to our purpose, what it means for us to be who we are as human beings. And that's great. That's an answer that we are all familiar with, to glorify God, enjoy Him forever. We're made in the image of His glory and all of these kinds of things. But what I've been wanting to do in the past few Sundays and in the Sundays to come and today is to really delve into the depths of what this means to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And what exactly is the text saying and how does it speak to us? And what are some of the details that we can draw out about this idea? We're looking, therefore, for other places in the Scriptures that speak to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Is there any other place in the Scriptures, is there any other place in the Bible that treats Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 that might help us sort of dig into its depths and sort of uncover its richer meanings? And the answer to that question is yes, there are. And there are two specific passages that we can think of. And the first is Proverbs chapter 8. And you know that we've been in Proverbs chapter 8 for a long time. We're going to briefly review it again this afternoon. And the other place is John chapter 1 in the Gospel of John. John chapter 1, verse 1 through 18, which is what I hope to get to this afternoon and cover with you this afternoon. But before I get there, I want to cover Proverbs chapter 8 again just briefly. We've not been together for a few weeks. I want to review some of the things that we covered that we've already seen from Proverbs chapter 8. So remember what we've said about Proverbs chapter 8 so far. It is in Proverbs chapter 8 where Solomon is extolling the virtues of wisdom. He is defining for us what wisdom is. He's dealing with the idea and the subject matter of wisdom, which at first you say to yourself, well, does that have any real bearing on Genesis 1:26? Well, it does, but we'll get there. But it's a portion that Solomon is essentially preaching a sermon there in Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs chapter 1 through 9 is a sermon on wisdom and the virtues of wisdom. And Proverbs chapter 8 is getting really to the point that he's wanting to make. And it has a lot to do with Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And Solomon's basic conclusion there in Proverbs chapter 8 is that this wisdom that he's been extolling and preaching on, whom he has personified in the eyes of his listeners, is God Himself, has the very same attributes of God. Wisdom flows from God. God is the source of all wisdom. And we were made in wisdom's image. That's the conclusion that he eventually reaches to. That we were made in wisdom's image to have a relationship with God the same way that wisdom has a relationship with God, which he brings out and we're going to look at here from Proverbs chapter 8. A relationship through his own word. But the question is how does Solomon reach that conclusion? How does he get there? Well, there's a few things you'll remember that we've spoken about concerning Solomon. And the first thing is, as we think about Solomon and we think about why he wrote the book of Proverbs and how did he make the conclusion that he came to in Proverbs chapter 8, we remember that he's a genius. That's one of the things that we have to remember about Solomon. From 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, we remember reading that he had wisdom and understanding beyond measure. And that he had breadth of mind like sand on the seashore. So we're not dealing with just an everyday Joe here. We're dealing with somebody who has real insight, who can really see into matters. And we also remember about Solomon something important and helpful to us, which is that he's the inheritor of the Davidic covenant. And let me remind you again briefly what the Davidic covenant is. You'll remember that David wanted to build God a house. He wanted to build God a temple. And so God sends his prophet Nathan to David and says to David, David, I appreciate what you're trying to do here, but you're not going to build me a temple. You're not going to build me a house that I can dwell in. No, David, I'm going to up you one. I'm going to build you a house. And I'm going to give you a kingdom. And I'm going to give it to your sons after you, to your offspring. And they're going to sit on your throne and they're going to rule on your kingdom, and your kingdom is going to be an everlasting kingdom, and your throne is never going to come to an end. And God says to David that there is going to be a son of David, and God is going to be a father to that son, and that son is going to be God's own son. And if God's son sins against him, then he will discipline him with the rod of men, but he will never take away his steadfast love. He will never take away his covenant commitment to him. It's an everlasting covenant with David's sons. Well, this is the Davidic covenant. Well, here comes Solomon. Solomon is the first inheritor of this covenant. David is the first one in human history to be called a son of God and to sit on the throne of his father David and to build God a house, or to build the house that David wanted to build, that God wouldn't let him build. And so you have to understand that this is where Solomon is coming from. And what we want to do is we want to sort of get ourselves in Solomon's mindset as we think about this. We want to put ourselves in his shoes because it's quite an amazing place to be. Many of us can't really relate to him necessarily, but we can imagine what it must have been like to be him. So here is Solomon, who is the son of David, has essentially been called the son of God, and is thinking about what this really means and what the implications for this are. Knows that he's first in the line of sons who are going to come to become David's dynasty. He's maybe spending some time imagining what this is going to be like for his son and his grandson and the sons after him. And he knows that somewhere down the line, there's a great-great-grandson who's going to sit on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom is never going to come to an end. He's going to live forever. And he's contemplating all of this, and he's thinking, what is the meaning of all of this? What's going on here? And he's thinking about himself as the father, the grandfather of this one who is to come, and what kind of responsibilities that means for him as he teaches his children and he teaches his grandchildren and so on. So put yourself in his shoes and the mindset that he must have been in at the time. Also consider what he would have been thinking in terms of redemptive history. Because Solomon now understands himself to be this great son of David who's building God a house. In many ways, Solomon is beginning to see himself, must have seen himself, as a kind of new Adam. Understanding that his grandson down the line is going to be a fulfillment of a perfect Adam. And he's putting all these pieces together in his mind, and he's thinking about the fact that whoever his son is going to be the one who fulfills all that God intended with Adam. and the fulfillment of all the promises that God gave to Eve and to the patriarchs, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Whoever this son is going to be as a king and as a ruler is going to be a fulfillment of the Mosaic covenant and of the law of God and of all the rest. And he's thinking about these things. It must have been on his mind. Well, here comes the real genius of Solomon then. Because as he's thinking about this Messiah to come, this anointed king who will have an eternal throne, he knows something that's undeniably true, which is that God's only Savior is Yahweh Himself. The true Savior of Israel is not a mere human being. It's a human being, perhaps, but it must be more than that. It must be God Himself. Who else can it be? Who else can be the Savior of Israel but God Himself? And so as Solomon is thinking about these things, he realizes that if this one, this man who is to rise up, is to fulfill the Davidic covenant, who's going to fulfill all of God's word, then this man is wisdom himself. He's the embodiment of wisdom. You see, and that's Solomon's train of thought. That's where he comes to in Proverbs chapter 8. So how does this affect his writing then? Well, when he writes Proverbs chapter 8, you have to understand that he has two audiences in mind. The first person that he's thinking about is his son, the perfect fulfillment, the grandson down the road who's going to fulfill all of God's promises. He's thinking about the embodiment of wisdom. And that's who he's writing to in many ways. And then the second audience that he has is the rest of Israel, whose great goal in life is to live up to the expectation of this son to come, which in the new covenant we would say whose task it is to be conformed to his image. And so Solomon is writing the book of Proverbs from this perspective. And that's why we see Proverbs what it is. It's a book on what it means to be wise and the difference between a wise man and a fool man, a foolish man, in order to encourage us to embrace wisdom. So now think about this for a minute. So here's the one, think of Solomon writing first of all to his first audience, to the son who is to come. What must be motivating Solomon? He's writing to the coming Messiah to teach him who he is and what it means to be a man, what it means to be human. And I've mentioned that before. And that's the purpose that he has here. He wants the one to come to know that he's more than a man. He is a man. He's fully and truly man. But he's something more than this. He's the embodiment of wisdom itself. He's the fulfillment of all of God's word, the fulfillment of all of God's purpose. He's the fulfillment of wisdom itself in human flesh. And this is motivating his writing in Proverbs chapter 8. And I want you to think about this. Can you imagine for a moment being, put yourself in Jesus' shoes, who is, in fact, the fulfillment of all of this. He is the son of Solomon, son of David. And what it must have been like in his humanity to be reading the book of Proverbs. And for, I don't know, for the first time, humanly speaking, realizing, recognizing, putting all the pieces together about why he was born and who he is and what that means and all the rest that comes with it. You know, I guess we don't think about that very often. But there must have been a time, there must have been a place, there must have been a time of day. I wonder if it stuck in Jesus' mind as he thought about it and as he came to that realization. Exactly what it means for him to be the Son of the Most High and Emmanuel. And all of those promises that came to his mother, which they surely would have taught him. He's reading Proverbs chapter 8, and he realizes that he's the begotten of God. He's the wisdom of God, not made before all worlds. Well, it must have been a powerful moment in the human experience of the eternal Son of God. But this is why Solomon is writing. This is what's motivating him, and it's important that we grasp that idea. Well, then for the rest of us, for the rest of Israel, for his other audience, which is the rest of humanity, what he's doing is he's teaching us what it means and why it matters to us that there is wisdom and that wisdom is God and that wisdom is that which will be enfleshed. So if you'll look with me really quickly at Proverbs chapter 8, I want to go back over what we saw there before we jump into John chapter 1. So look with me at Proverbs chapter 8. In the first part of chapter 8, verse 1 through 11, Solomon is sort of dealing with his audience. And he is answering the question, okay, Solomon, we've read chapter 1 through 7. You've been telling us about wisdom and what wisdom is and its virtues and all the rest. Why is this important to us? Why do we care? Why do we want to listen to you? Why should we believe you on what wisdom is and all the rest? And he gives this answer that the reason why you should listen to wisdom is because wisdom is infallible. Her words are true and they do not fail. They cannot fail. And then the question is, of course, raised, why should we believe that her words are infallible and that they cannot fail and they cannot fall? And Proverbs, Solomon answers in verse 12 through 21, because she is God. And he begins to lay out there her attributes, and her attributes are the very attributes of God himself. And Solomon essentially is making the claim that wisdom is equal with God. Wisdom is divine. She has all the attributes of God. She's powerful. She's sovereign. She's good. She's merciful. It's very clear. I went through it. I'm not going to go through it again this afternoon. What I am going to cover again is verse 22 through 31 briefly. We went into it into some detail last time we were together. And here Solomon is dealing with the question of, okay, Solomon, wisdom is infallible. Wisdom is God. But why does this matter to me? Why should I listen to wisdom? Why is this important to me, Solomon? And then this is when Solomon really unpacks on us and really goes deep into the issues at hand. And essentially what he answers is, not only is wisdom God, but wisdom is with God. And wisdom is the one who made you and made you to be in his in wisdom's image. It's what it means for you to be you is to care about wisdom. And to be cared about by wisdom. Anyway, let's see what he has to say here, because this is good stuff. What he's talking about here is the relationship between wisdom and God. Of course, he's touching here on profound mysteries. He's touching on the doctrine of the Trinity. But let's look at the text. Verse 22. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, just remind you of a few images that we see here. The first is, the Lord possessed me. This is wisdom speaking. Wisdom is personified in this passage. And this is how she speaks in verse 22. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work. And I reminded you last time we were together how important that word possessed is. And I want to remind you again this afternoon. That word possessed means to acquire. It's the picture, the word fundamentally is the picture of a woman possessing or holding or having just acquired for the first time, her newborn baby, or a father holding in his arms close to his chest for the first time, his firstborn. And so you who have had babies, you who have had children, Abby and I don't have any children, so I've never experienced this. But you who have are going to know the importance and the significance of this idea. It's a picture of perfect happiness. Perfect peace, tenderness, care, and probably a whole slew of words that are unspeakable, but they're all good and wonderful and amazing. Okay? And that's the picture that we have here. Yahweh holding wisdom in his arms, like a father would hold his firstborn for the first time. Yahweh possessed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. In other words, this picture of Yahweh holding wisdom in his arms as his generated one, as his boy in his arms, is eternal and everlasting. It's the very identity of God himself. It's what it means for God to be God. We spent some time talking about what it means to be brought forth. And the technical term there is to be generated or generation. This is where we get the idea of eternal generation, that the Son is eternally generated of the Father. And when we think about being brought forth, we remember that we have to be careful here because we're not speaking about a creature. We're speaking about the divine. And so although the generation of the Son is something that we can relate to, because we bring forth children, we need to make sure we subtract every creaturely imperfection from it when we think about it in a divinity. So God doesn't have a body, so the generation of the Son doesn't include any kind of biological mechanism. God doesn't change, so there's no moment of change in God. There's a huge change for us when we bear children. Our whole life turns upside down. It's a whole new life. But there's no change in God. This is everlasting, eternal, immutable. Right? There's no pain in God in the generation of the Son or of wisdom here. So we have to subtract all those kinds of ideas. We're talking about some kind of perfect divine generation which is eternal and immutable and impassable and wonderful and full of grace and full of glory and full of love. We pick back up again in verse 27. When he established the heavens, I was there. So far we've been speaking about before the world, and now we're speaking about the beginning. We're talking about now we're in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And wisdom is saying, I was there. I made the heavens and the earth with God. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, that's a reference to the Spirit hovering over the face of the waters. He's saying, I was there. When he made firm the skies above, that's day two, when he makes the firmament and divides the waters that are under the firmament from the waters that are above the firmament. When he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth, that's day three, when God separates land and sea. Wisdom is saying, I was there on day three. I was with him. But notice how wisdom describes her presence. Verse 30, then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily his delight. We see here that Solomon's mind is firmly planted in Genesis chapter 1, all the days of creation. He's mentioned just a few to get the point across. But we're on day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, day 7. And wisdom is there beside him. Beside his father, like a master craftsman. That word master craftsman is something that we should pay attention to. It means two different ideas, but I think we can combine the two to understand the interpretation of this passage. On one hand, a master craftsman, that word in Hebrew means one brought up, one who's been raised to do something. And then the idea of master craftsman is what it is he's been raised up to do. It's the work of an artisan. And essentially what wisdom is saying is that I am the son, the one who's been generated, who has been, as it were, raised up or brought up to be co-creator with my father, to make the worlds with him. And the picture here is of a father and his son working together. And I made this illustration last time, and I'm going to review it again briefly. So, dads who are in the room, think about when you were raising your kids and maybe you took them out to mow the lawn with you, to do some kind of yard work, or maybe you took them into your wood shop with you. And think about the experience that you had with your boy. Or this is the picture that's being painted to us. Is there's the father and beside him is his son, the son that he's raising up to do the same work that he does. And again, fathers, if you mow, right, you usually will get like a little toy mow, lawnmower for your boy, and you'll mow, and then he'll be right behind dad, or he'll be picking up the leaves or the grass or whatever. working with dad. And if dad's in the tool shop and he's hammering on something, the boy's been given some kind of tool and some kind of block that he can hammer on. And whatever the father does, the son does also. If the father hammers the wood, the boy is right next to dad, looking up at dad, enjoying the whole experience, hammering the wood. And the picture that we're given of here is that this is what's happening in creation. It's the father and his son, and they're working together in creating the heavens and the earth. If the father says, let there be light, the boy says, let there be light. One voice, one essence, one nature. If the father makes the firmament and divides the waters from the waters, the boy with him makes the firmament and divides the water from the waters. And that's the picture that we have. And the son, or wisdom, is daily his delight. So the father is loving his son the whole time. There's an expression of love. This whole work is done in love and from love and out of love. And so I want to focus your attention on this. Look at verse 30 again. It says, I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always. So we looked at the word delight. Daily, the delight of the Father. That is, he was the object of the Father's love. All that the Father was doing in creating the cosmos was out of this intense love that he has for his boy, for his son. He delighted in him. Not a moment, not a single day passed, not a single work of God was done apart from the love that he has for his son. He delighted in him the whole time. And the son, in reciprocation to this love, rejoices before him. And I showed you that word rejoice means essentially to play or to dance or to entertain. And again, you see the picture of a father and a son. You see the son loved by the father, working with the father, enjoying the whole thing, every moment of it with his father. And this is the picture that we have. It's a beautiful picture. It's a gracious picture. But something else amazing happens in verse 31, because this son, this wisdom of God, who is playing in the cosmos with God as they are forming the whole thing, is rejoicing in the cosmos. And specifically his delight, that is his love, is directed to the children of Adam. Verse 31, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the children of Adam, or the children of man. So the point that Solomon is making is that why should we care what wisdom has to say, and why does wisdom care about us? And the answer is because wisdom is the one who made us with her father. And don't let that pronoun trip you up. I keep saying her, but there's a grammatical reason for that I'm not going to go into right now. If you're curious about it, I'll answer any questions about it. It's purely grammatical. But here's wisdom with her father. Here's the son with his father, creating mankind to be the image of the love and the joy and the delight that the father and the son have from all eternity. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? It means to be made in the image of his grace, of his love, of his joy, and of his delight. What does it mean to be like him? It means to enter into the fellowship that exists between the father and the son. These are profound things that I'm saying to you. Eternal things. Wonderful things. So this is Solomon, Proverbs chapter 8. What it means to be human is to be made in the image of wisdom. And specifically, in the image of her love that she shares with her father. Well, look with me then at John chapter 1. Because what John is going to do is he's also going to look back at Genesis chapter 1. But he's specifically going to do it through the filter of Solomon. So Solomon is thinking about Genesis 1, and John is thinking about Genesis 1 in light of Solomon. And here's what John says, words that you're pretty familiar with, but let's take a look at them again in light of the things that we've been thinking about. In the beginning, all right, we're in Genesis chapter 1, in arche, which means first principles. We're in the beginning. We're in Genesis 1. We're in the beginning of everything, in fact, is what John is saying. John is saying we're in the most profound sense in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word. Now, he doesn't use the word wisdom. He uses the word word, or the Greek word logos. The word logos means statement. It means sentence. It means reason. It can mean reason. It can mean message. It can mean all of these kinds of things. I think the best way to understand word, though, the idea that's behind message and sentence and statement and reason, is the idea of purpose or intention. When we say that in the beginning was the Word, we're saying in the beginning was the reason why. Like the ultimate reason why. The reason why for everything. And that which is going to give definition to everything. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And again, you can't miss it. John is there with Solomon in Proverbs chapter 8. That's where he's getting what he's saying from. That's the template that he's following, because that's what Solomon said in Proverbs chapter 8. Wisdom is God, and wisdom was with God. So here he is in Proverbs chapter 8. In fact, the things that he's going to say in these first five verses all have to do, they're right out, he's lifting them essentially right out of Solomon. He's basically just summarizing for us Proverbs chapter 8. In the beginning was the Word, this reason why, this organizing principle, this wisdom of God. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. He's His Son. All things were made through Him. And without Him was not anything made that was made. Proverbs chapter 8. We just read the words. Daily His delight. In Him was life. And the life was the light of men. This word's specific object of love is mankind. It's man that His attention is focused on. That's the focus of Genesis chapter 1. It's the focus of Proverbs chapter 8. John is summarizing it, bringing it out here. In Him was life. That is, of course, that He's the source of life for all that He's created, and He's the source of life for man. But the point that John is making is the same point that Solomon was making, which is the same point that Moses is making in Genesis chapter 1, which is that He's the purpose. He's the meaning. He's that which gives definition to our everything. He is our life, and He is our light. He is that which brings clarity and distinction and definition to what it means for us to be who we are. He's just summarizing Proverbs chapter 8. Verse 5, this light, this Word of God, shines in darkness. And that refers to the fact that this wisdom of God, this Word of God, this light of God, although we read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 of a very pristine and perfect creation, is still shining, but shining now into a darkened and fallen world. Is shining upon fools, which is what Solomon would have said. The light shines in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. Although the Word is the reason why for everything, He's the life and light of men. Men don't get it. They are in darkness, and they've chosen darkness, and they love darkness. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not comprehended it or grasped it. The ESV says overcome it. But the idea of that word is to not grasp. They haven't gotten it. They haven't comprehended. Verse 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This is in reference to John the Baptist. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. And all the apostle is getting at here is that John the Baptist is not the reason why. That's not who we're referring to here. He's pointing to the reason why. As all the prophets of the Old Testament were pointing to this Word, so John the Baptist points to this Word. He's not the Word. He's pointing to it. And John is what the apostle is doing here is he's building up a crescendo. He's speaking about this eternal, everlasting word, which is God, which is the same God of the Old Testament, which is the same God of Solomon. And all the Old Testament prophets have spoken in the name of this word and have pointed to the coming of this word, and he's beginning to shine. Now, it's easy for us at this point to just begin to leap to the conclusion of the incarnation. But John is crescendoing to that point. And if you don't understand, if you can't suspend your disbelief, you're not going to really feel the impact of what John is trying to get at here. But let's keep reading. Verse 9. The true light. Well, John's not the light, but the true light, which gives light to everyone. This word, this reason why, this clarity. Who gives light to everyone, who is the reason why for everything, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. This is meant to provoke in us a sense of tragedy and a sense of pity. It's meant to remind us of the ignorance of the world. Here is God who created everything and all men everywhere, all the Gentile nations and all the rest. And he has shone into the darkness of the human race. He has come into his own creation, into his own world, and his own world doesn't know him. They're completely oblivious to the fact of his presence. They don't know. And it provokes in us a sense of pity. Well, not only this, not only is this everlasting, eternal world, word coming into his world, but he's coming specifically to his own nation, to the people of Israel. Verse 11, he came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Right? It's a different relationship. The world doesn't know him. His people reject him. They know who he is. They know that he's the Messiah. They know that he's Yahweh. But they don't receive him, and they don't believe in him. Again, this provokes in us a sense of tragedy. But in this case, not pity, perhaps anger. Because they know him, they know better. They should receive him. And they don't receive him, but they reject him instead. But there's a third group of people, surprisingly, that's mentioned in verse 12. Wonderfully. Gloriously, there's a third group of people, but to all who did receive him, and this is to anybody, Jew or Gentile, in all the world, for anybody who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. This is this third group of people, of Gentile and Jew, who are born again in the Spirit of the power of God, not of the work of men or of the will of man or of anything in the flesh or the power of the flesh. But God has done a miraculous work and opened up their eyes and brought them to faith in this one who is the light, who is the reason why, who's coming into the world. And they do receive him by faith. And they have this awesome privilege of being called children of God. And you can see the significance of the link that John is making between here, the word in Proverbs chapter 8. Because who else has the right to make someone the child of God but the Son of God himself? But the one who is the possession of Yahweh, who is the one who is daily his delight in creating the heavens and the earth. But whoever receives in him, whoever believes in him, is given this right to become children of God, sons of God. Well, then verse 14, right? Here it comes. Here's the crash of the fireball from heaven. The crescendo has been building. Here's the explosion. And the Word became flesh. It's not just that he entered into a world of darkness. It's not just that he came into the world and the world didn't know him. It's not just that he came to his people and his people rejected him. It's not just that he has the right to give them the right to be called children of God. It's that he takes on their own nature. He comes as one of them. He has flesh. And the reason why, and the wisdom, or as John says, the Logos, the Word, became flesh and dwelt among us. This is the climactic moment that all of human history has been building up to this point. In order to really understand the full impact of what's happening in verse 14, I want you to think of it like this. I want you to imagine a world in which sin never entered, if you can do that. A world in which God creates the heavens and the earth in 6 days as a temple, and He places Adam and Eve within that temple, and they resist the serpent, and they don't fall away from God, and they don't break covenant with Him. And they begin to fill and to multiply on the earth and to subdue the earth and to hold dominion over it in perfect righteousness, in obedience to God. And the whole world becomes filled with a race of perfect human beings, the offspring of Adam and Eve. And then one day, the Almighty, God Himself, the Son of Yahweh, the wisdom of God, comes down from heaven in the form of human flesh in one of the children of Adam and Eve. And all that creation has always been around for, it has existed for, and all that humanity has worked for in their perfect, righteous dominion and subjection of everything to build this perfect temple for God, finally comes to pass. God Himself takes up residence as a man in the temple made for Him. And all of humanity reaches its greatest pinnacle. The very reason it exists has occurred. Its perfect joy, its perfect happiness has dawned upon it. The very angels sing with joy and glory. Can you get the picture? That's the idea. You have to have that idea. You have to have that picture in your mind. Because if you don't get it, then you're not going to understand the significance of the fact that God still does it despite the fact of sin. Despite the fact that we don't deserve it at all, that we're unworthy. He still comes into a world of darkness. He comes into a world of ignorance. He comes into a world of rejection. Because there's nothing that's going to stop Him from His grand purpose, which He's had before the worlds began. To make the world a temple and to glorify Himself in it. And to do so in flesh, in human flesh. Well, that's the significance there. This Word became flesh and dwelt among us. He came to what was supposed to be a pristine temple, but totally ruined by sin. And yet He came. And we have seen His glory. The glory as of the only begotten Son from the Father. And again, John is firmly planted in Proverbs chapter 8. Where else can he be? He's the glory of the only begotten Son from the Father. His glory is revealed. Again, this is Proverbs chapter 8. But what we're seeing here, the glory that's being expressed to us in this Son is the glory of the love that the Father has for the Son. It's that picture that we saw earlier of the Father holding His Son, His perfect peace, perfect grace, all this tenderness, this love. The glory has been made revealed. It's been made flesh. And we've seen it with our eyes. It's been drawn on the contours of the visage of Jesus Christ. It's been choreographed in His life of suffering and of pain and of His subsequent glories and resurrection. This is what John is getting at. We've seen His glory in the face of man, full of grace and truth. This idea here of grace and truth is again the idea of this delight that the Father and the Son share from all eternity, this love, joy, fellowship between the two of them from all eternity. The truth is in reference to their faithfulness to mankind, although mankind has been unfaithful to them, as well as the idea of this grand purpose. The truth, that which gives definition and meaning, this organizing principle, which we call wisdom.
grace and truth. And He's full of grace and truth. He's full of the love that the Father has of the Son. He's full of this purpose and intention, and it's an immeasurable glory. And yet it's revealed in human flesh. Verse 15, John bore witness about Him and cried out, "This was He of whom I said, 'He who comes after Me ranks before Me because He was before Me.'" And really, that's only inserted there to remind us that this One that John is speaking about is not just a mere man. This is the Logos enfleshed from all eternity, who has assumed a human nature, who has taken on the nature of a man. He is truly God, truly man. But He doesn't want us to lose this idea that Jesus is from all eternity. The Father's relationship with Him is an eternal relationship. That which has been revealed is that which is from all eternity. He doesn't want us to miss this because of what He's going to say next in verse 16. From His fullness, we have all received grace upon grace. And the idea here then is that the Word of God was made known. This is similar to what I preached on from John 3:16. He's not here to condemn. He's here to save. He's not here to tear down the world. He's here to repair it and to restore it. He's here for grace, grace upon grace. From His fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Your translation might read grace for grace. But the idea that John is getting at here is an infinite amount of grace, an infinite series of grace. Grace upon grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. So much grace you don't know what to do with yourself. An insane amount of grace. Can I use some slang? A wild amount of grace. A ridiculous amount of grace. A stupid amount of grace. An amount of grace that you can't even begin to measure. Grace. Love, tenderness, delight, joy, eternal. Grace upon grace. That's what He's getting at there. For from the fullness of this Son who is with the Father from all eternity. Grace upon grace. And then He compares and contrasts Jesus Christ and His grace with Moses. The grace that's coming to us from the Word with the old law. Verse 17, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Now His purpose here is to fix our minds on the real meaning of this grace. Because we call to mind what the law was all about. The law was definitely a communication of grace. And you say to yourself, how can that be? Well, of course, the law is, if you think of the Ten Commandments specifically, let's focus our attention on the Ten Commandments. We could look at the ceremonial law. There's a lot of grace in the ceremonial law because there was a way for forgiveness through the ceremonial law. But let's think about the Ten Commandments for just a moment. The Ten Commandments are a description to us of what it means to be a gracious person. A gracious, tender, loving person is somebody who worships God and worships God alone and doesn't take His name in vain and keeps the Sabbath day and obeys his parents. And doesn't murder or take the life of others or get angry or become bitter at them. It's somebody who's faithful to their spouse and faithful to their obligations. It's someone who doesn't take other people's things but works hard so that he might give to them. Right? This is all a picture of grace to us. They don't lie or stab people in the back. They don't covet other people's things. They're not jealous of other people. They're thankful for the gifts that God gives to other people. They're gracious. They're holy. The problem with the law is not that it doesn't communicate grace. The problem is it doesn't have any power to communicate grace to the sinner. It's an external standard. It's a written description of grace on tablets of stone. But it doesn't have any power to make a person who's not gracious, gracious. If a sinner comes to the law and says, I want to be like what the law tells me I should be. The law says, sorry, bud, you're condemned. You don't measure up. And I can't help you because I'm just a tablet of stone. I'm just words written. And we remember the mediator of this law. The law was given through Moses.
this external standard placed on the head of sinners, which does nothing but condemn them, but has no power to save them. Moses is the mediator of this covenant. Well, brothers and sisters, Moses was a wonderful man. And he was loved by God. And he did marvelous work, work that we're very thankful for. But fundamentally, Moses was flawed like all the rest of us. Fundamentally, Moses was a man of darkness. Fundamentally, Moses was graceless. If it wasn't for the grace of God, Moses would have been the worst sinner as any of us would have been. And this was the mediator of this old law. It was a mere description of grace to graceless people from a graceless person. This can be illustrated for us. When you think of Moses, turn with me really quickly to Numbers. Numbers chapter 20. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But you remember, I want to illustrate to you the problem with Moses as a mediator. That fundamentally he was a man who was graceless. And although he had received a lot of grace, and we're very thankful for Moses, Moses was fundamentally a sinner like the rest of us. Numbers chapter 20. You remember the incident that happens at Meribah? Some of you are shaking your head. You do remember. Moses has taken, by God's command and by God's help, the children of Israel out of Egypt. He's rescued them from their oppressors. The children of Israel, as you remember, are very rebellious and difficult people to work with. And they're in the wilderness. And they are thirsty and they are hungry and they begin to complain. They begin to gripe and whine and say, "We're thirsty and we're hungry. Why did you rescue us out of Egypt? What is this all about? I thought you were going to bring us into a land of milk and honey. I thought you were going to bring us into a promised land. Oh, that we were back in Egypt." Now, you can imagine what this must have done to Moses, who in many ways was personally invested in this whole project, who had gone before Pharaoh and led the people out and managed them day to day, given them the law of God. You can imagine what kind of stress that would have been on his shoulders. You must imagine the love that he must have had for the people of Israel. And so he must have taken this personally to some extent. Because here these people are, and they're complaining about being rescued from slavery. And they want to go back. And on top of it all, you know Moses was a man who was zealous for the glory of God. He loved the Lord. And these people are not really complaining against Moses. And Moses knows that they're complaining against God Himself. And he's infuriated. He's angry about this. How dare these people? These ingrates. Unthankful. So here's what God does, though. God chooses to magnify His holiness. And He says to Moses, "Moses, I know the people are complaining, but here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to a rock." There's a rock there. "I want you to go to the rock, and I want you to speak to the rock. And when you speak to the rock, water will flow, and the children of Israel will be fed. Their thirst will be quenched." It was a picture, you see, of God's grace. In the midst of their unthankfulness and their whining and their complaining, God was going to provide for them. And He was going to provide for them graciously water from the rock, which we know from Paul is a type of Christ. What does Moses do? You remember what Moses does. He can't control himself. He doesn't believe God's grace. He doesn't want to believe God's grace. Look with me at chapter 20, verse 10. "Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock." And this is Moses speaking, and Moses said to them, "Hear now, you rebels." Let me put that in the vernacular. "You rats, you ingrates, you worthless children." "Shall we bring water for you out of this rock?"
he's angry with them. And Moses lifted up his hand and he struck the rock with his staff twice. And water came out abundantly and the congregation drank and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. And you know what happened to Moses? His carcass fell in the wilderness like the rest of that generation who didn't believe in the grace of God. When we read their holiness, you have to understand that's the grace of God. It's the holiness of His grace. I've preached on this before and I missed that point, but I've got it now. That's what that means. It's His grace. Well, you see, Moses was a graceless man in a covenant that could not impart grace. And that's the significance of what John says next in the text when he says, the law came through Moses, but grace and truth, the thing itself, not something that talks about it, not an external standard that reminds us that we don't measure up to it, but the thing itself, grace and truth, the love and the delight and the joy and the communion and the fellowship with God that has been between the Father and the Son for all eternity, has been revealed not through a graceless man, Moses, through an imperfect mediator whose carcass fell in a wilderness, but through Jesus Christ, the Son of God. You see, and that's the crescendo. There John is. He hasn't mentioned Jesus Christ this far in the text. But Jesus Christ is this one. He's the Son of God made flesh. And He is not graceless, but He is grace Himself, the embodiment of it. There's no darkness in Him. He's sinless. He's perfect. And His carcass doesn't fall in the wilderness. And when it does, on the cross, He's raised again in the power of God, vindicated, because He cannot be held down by death. Death has no claim on Him. Well, that brings us to verse 18. John chapter 1, verse 18. We have these profound words, these summary statement of what John has been getting at. And he says this. He says, no one has ever seen God. These are probably some of the most profound words. I mean, the whole verse, verse 18, is probably some of the most profound words written in all of the Bible. This is just one of those texts that touches on eternity itself. But here's what he says. No one has ever seen God. Right? This is significant. We want to think about that for just a minute because we do know about God. Every creature, the Bible witnesses to the fact, tells us that we know that there is a God. But we've never seen Him. We don't know who He is. Have you ever had to meet somebody for the first time and you've heard a lot about them and you know something about their reputation, you've heard their credentials, but you've never seen their face, you've never met them, and you have to meet them? Maybe you have to go before a lawyer or a judge, or maybe you have to have a job interview or something like this, and you're going to go before somebody you've never met, and you know all kinds of things about them, but you don't know them, and you don't know what their purpose or their intention is towards you, and you know the experience because it's frightening, it's fearful, it's intimidating. This is the idea that John is getting at here. No one has ever seen God. We know that there is a God, but we don't know what His purposes or His intentions are. Not by the light of nature. No one has ever seen God. Well, this is the good news. The only begotten God, which again is a reference to Proverbs chapter 8, the one who is in the Father's bosom, which is the next phrase there. He who is at the Father's side is the way the ESV puts it. The original Greek is he who is in the chest of the Father, and our mind is being drawn back to Proverbs chapter 8 with the picture of a father is holding his firstborn for the first time in the grace and the tenderness and the love and the affection and the peace that comes with that image and all the other inexpressibly wonderful things. It's this one who is the reason why of God, who is our very purpose for being. whose love and delight is in the Father, and rebounding from the Father is the one who loves and delights in the children of Adam. It's this one who has made Him known, who tells us who God is, and what His intentions and what His purposes are for us, which are not purposes of condemnation, but purposes of salvation. Not purposes of gracelessness like Moses in the wilderness, but purposes of grace as revealed in Jesus Christ. So that, brothers and sisters, what it means to be made in the image of God is to be made in the image of the Word, who is the wisdom of God. It's to be the image of the glory of the love and the grace that exists between the Father and Son from all eternity. And to be in a relationship with them, which they have shared from all eternity. And this is our everything. This is our reason why. This is our wisdom, which is to say, our everything, our life and our light. Okay, well, what we'll do next time then, we've looked at the text. We've looked at Genesis 1:26, Proverbs 8, John 1. We're going to wrap this all up, draw out its theological implications, and bring it all to a close.